We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on bluechipspeakersnaba.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it's only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And I think Tim has got our introducer of our speaker coming up.
Thank you, Mims. I'm Frank Waters, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. And our speaker tonight is Angela C. something. She's always been Angela C. to me. I've known Angela for at least 20 years in the program. She's here to carry the message, not the mess. And in my opinion, she has always carried herself with a lot of self-respect, which is needs no other introduction. A lot of self-respect. Angela.
Thank you. Hey, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Angela. And thanks again, Frank. Thanks for having me here tonight, Tim. I am a grateful alcoholic. I haven't always been able to say that. My sobriety date is January 11th, 1990. And that's basically when my life began. I was born in Texas. I am a proud Texan. I'm the youngest of four girls. My parents were separated when my mother found out she was pregnant with me. And then she got back together with my dad. And because that's what you do, you know. So the baby would have a name. And my dad was a binge drinker. And I remember when I was little, I would see those red, white, and blue Budweiser cans in the bottom of the fridge, and I knew they were bad. That's all I knew. I just knew they were bad things, because that's what Mom says. I loved the outdoors. I was a little tomboy. We lived in a small town, and as far as I knew, I had a very normal childhood. My mom stayed home until I was in the third grade, and we went to church three times a week, and all I remember from church was that it was hell, fire, and brimstone, and one thing out of line, and you're going straight to hell. So as I became older, I became very leery of that, and honestly, I'm still kind of leery of all the religion thing, and I'm glad that AA is not about religion. It's great if that's what works for people. Well, wonderful. This is what works for me. This is where I get my spirituality. And I'm glad to know that today, because I thought for a long time that I was doing it wrong because I wasn't in a church. So this is my church. My sisters were 6, 8, and 10 years older than me, and we lived in a very small town of like 6,000 people. And my last sister had graduated, and we moved to the big city of 70,000 people. And I was in the 7th grade, so that was a really awkward time. And then going to a new school in a big city was even more awkward and fearful. I learned what designer clothes were, because my mother had made all of my clothes, and like designer jeans. And I always thought the Jordache one, I thought it was pronounced Jordache. But it didn't take me long to get all of that figured out. My first taste of alcohol, I was in the 8th grade, and I was at a friend's house, and she said, hey, come try this stuff. It's really good. It's called Cream de Menthe. And I touched my tongue to the cap of it, and I was like, oh, that does really taste good. But I knew it was wrong, so I didn't do it again. And we put it away. I think she may have had a cap full or something, but... My mom didn't drink, and other than those Budweiser cans in the refrigerator periodically, there was never any alcohol around. Now I know that the alcoholic behavior was always there, but the actual substance wasn't. I went to high school, and I was terrified. I went to a school of about 9,000, or not 9,000, sorry, 9th grade, 2,000 people, and I went to my first party, and I remember drinking the punch, and someone said, yeah, it's spiked, and it had Everclear or something in it, and I'd already drank a lot of it, and I was really angry that they would do that. You know, how dare they spike the punch? And ended up getting very ill and sick to my stomach, but I don't consider that really my first drunk because, you know, I wasn't aware of what I was doing. But so I went there, did that, big high school. I was scared to death. I dropped out of band. I was a sax player. And I dropped out of theater, which I really enjoyed. And just kind of withdrew into myself. I went to Galveston for the first time. It was the first time to ever go to the beach. I was 15, and I just finished driver's ed. My mom was taking her registered nurse licensing exam, and I took a friend with me. And it was, I met the bellboy in the hotel, and he said, do you want to go riding around later? And I was like, yeah. And so he picked me up, but my friend, she wouldn't go. She said, I'll just stay in the lobby till y'all get back. And I said, okay. So he picks me up. He's got a 12-pack. And we drank a little bit of it and went back to the hotel, and we were exchanging addresses and phone numbers, and I look up and my mom is standing right in front of the car like this, and I was like, oh, I'm so busted. So I get out of the car, go up, and you know, I also stole her car and drove around Galveston while she was taking her exam. She never found out about that. But she did catch me a couple of other times before I got my license driving her car. So my first real drunk was I was 15, and I had met this guy who, a friend of mine, she liked him, and she was going to this football game, and she wanted us to come see her march, or she was on the flag corps or something. I said, sure. So we stopped, and we got some California coolers. I don't even know if they make those anymore. But we drank them, and on the way home, that I blacked out for the first time. And we had a tire. We in the back roads of East Texas. We were going pretty fast, and a tire blew out. So we spun around, and I remember waking up and seeing barbed wire in front of me, and the car stopped, and went home and got really sick, and my dad said, sugar, are you okay? And I was like, yeah, I think it's that old frozen food that we've had in the freezer for a long time. That's what I ate before I went out tonight. And that's kind of how it started, and that's how it continued. Every time I drank, I blacked out. And a friend of mine said, well, that's what's supposed to happen. And I'm like, cool. But I got this thing down. And skipping school, going to Dallas for the day, getting caught. I switched schools and went to a smaller high school, which was a little better, but I still always felt out of place and very insecure. And it's funny because when I've gone back for reunions or caught up with people on Facebook, they've said, what are you talking about? You were the most outgoing person. And I guess that's what I probably projected, but inside I was just scared of everything. So fear started long ago. And I'm having a lot of fear right now, if you can't tell. I don't know why. This is where I came when I got sober. Well, when I moved to Atlanta, these are the rooms that I came to. And the chairs were orange and the floor was brown. Yeah, brown, and you could smoke in here, and I always used to sit, and I always sat right here in front, and I'd always think about, wow, when I get a year, I want to tell my story at NAVA. And it took about 20 years before anyone asked me to tell my story here, but when I was in high school, in Texas, the drinking age was 18, and my sister had a paper driver's license that she gave me, and my friends and I would go use a piece of paper that said I was, I don't know, 22 or something, and buy alcohol in grocery stores, wherever, drive-thrus, where you can just order a drink to go. That was always cool. So I barely finished high school, and on the weekends, my best friend and I, when the drinking age in Texas went from 18 to 21, we would drive to Shreveport, Louisiana, which was only 60 miles away because the drinking age there was 18. And we would go over during the summer we would go every other day, and then on both days on the weekend, load up the car and head back to Longview, and just that's what we did. I went to a junior college in the area and partied myself out of that. I had one credit when I left there, and it was a C in badminton. And that's kind of how it went. So I remember in high school begging my whatever teacher, you know, please let me pass this, because if I don't, you know, I'm not going to be a junior, or I'm not going to graduate. And just by the skin of my teeth, you know, they probably just wrote it in and said, please just send her away. So I went to this little college and I partied myself out of there, and I met this guy who was a drummer, and he was going to New York, and I decided I was going with him. So I quit unenrolled in school and I took the money, and he was like, you're not going with me. And I was like, well, that sucks. Now I have to get a job because I've already wasted mom's money. So I went to the Ramada Inn, which was the nice hotel, and applied. And when I walked in, they said, we have a motel right down the hill from this that we think you'd be better suited for. Where it was like $20 a night or something. And I was like, okay. And the people there who, you know, I relieved, or the people who came in to relieve me after my shift or whatever, they all partied. So it was cool. But at that time, I don't think I identified that I feel really crappy, still partying and doing stuff. It was during that time. No, it wasn't. Anyway, I decided I wasn't going to live. I wasn't going to stay there. I was leaving. My oldest sister lived in Pennsylvania with her family and said, come up here, go to school, get out of there. She knew I was going nowhere. And so I went to Pennsylvania, I enrolled in school, worked at Chocolate World, which is part of Hershey, and the town really does smell like chocolate. It's pretty cool. And I went to school, met a guy, and he partied, and he partied harder than I had ever partied. So, of course, we hooked up. And I was just telling my husband the other night, or yesterday, that I remembered something that I had forgotten, and when I was in school in Pennsylvania, I went to Washington, D.C. with a business club group. And we were in line to go into the state capitol, and they had a security check thing. And I had another substance other than alcohol in my purse. And I was terrified that they were going to open my little film canister and see what was in there. And luckily, they didn't. But that was just a memory that I hadn't thought about in so long, and I was like, wow, I don't even think of those things anymore. You know, I don't have to be afraid where I go today. Thank goodness. So while I was in Pennsylvania, the boy I was dating got busted, and I packed my bags and my car, and went home to Texas, and moved in with a girl that I'd gone to high school with, and we were sitting around one night playing quarters, and I said, you know what? I don't want to live here. I don't want to live down the road from Mama in a double wide with dogs and cars up on cinder blocks. I don't want to do this, you know. And she said, I don't either. So I said, well, let's take this map, this Rand McNally that I still have, and we want to move to the beach. All right, let's go to Florida. All right, you pick three cities on the coast, and I'll pick three cities on the coast. And we put them in a jar, and I drew three times, and she drew three times, and we drew Fort Myers, both of us drew Fort Myers. My brother-in-law's brother was working in Bonita Springs, which is just south of there, and he said, come on down, I've got this big, huge condo, I work for this developer, it's empty, but you're welcome to come down. So we packed our cars, and we bought handheld CB radios. She was the beach bunny, and I was Wild Thing. And and I had a $100 bill that my daddy gave me and a left-handed cigarette, and off we went to Florida. And got down there, got jobs the first week. You know, this is awesome. We're just, you know, partying on the beach all the time. Actually, I was the one that was partying. She was the one who was, you know, ended up driving or scraping me up and pulling me places. The second week I was there, we were at Fort Myers Beach, and some guy on the beach said, hey, you want to go go for a boat ride. I'm like, sure, let's go. And I got on this boat. I only had a swimsuit. That was it. That was all I had. And I'm with these people, and everyone's drinking and partying. And he goes to make a pass at me, and I told him no, and he decked me right in the face. And my new swimsuit was ruined. That's all I could think of was there's blood stains all over this great, you know, swimsuit. And then I got scared because no one on the boat was taking up for me. And they were all friends, and I was the stranger, and it's dark, and we're somewhere north of where I'm supposed to be, out on the water. And I'm looking at the shoreline, and I'm thinking, there's no way in hell I can swim that far. Oh, my God, they're going to throw me overboard. This is it. And thankfully, I blacked out after that, and I don't remember. The next thing I remember, it was 6 in the morning, and they were dropping me off at the empty condo. And I obviously didn't go to work that day. I was pretty banged up and bruises and stuff. I went to file charges, and they said, it's on the water. We can't do anything for you. And I'm like, yeah, but I know where this guy works, and I know where all these people work. I want to file charges. And they were like, it's on the water. I can't help you. I went to a therapist at someone's suggestion, and she asked me if I thought I was an alcoholic, and I was like, no, my daddy is, but I'm not. And thankfully, I saw her about a year after that, and I said, hey, guess what? Guess what I am? And I actually saw her in a meeting, so that was pretty cool. She had me pegged. So, I hate to back up in my story, but when I had left Pennsylvania and gone back to Texas, I was out partying with a friend one night, and we got pulled over. I was driving his 1987 Mazda RX-7, and apparently I was speeding, and at 2 in the morning, and they pulled us over, and they could have busted us for everything under the sun, but I was just charged with minor consuming, and he was charged with contributing to a minor. And we spent the night in jail. And we were the only two people in there. And my mom came to get me the next morning because she had always said, do not call me. If you go to jail, you're going to spend the night. So I called my sister. And she called mom. And my mom called them, and she said, keep her. I don't want her. She came to get me the next morning, of course. And when we went to court, they gave us a refund of all of our money, my friend and me. So what we did? We went and partied. And then a few months later, that's when I got to Florida and all this other mess happened. So my sister, same sister, moves to Florida. And the first night she's there, I get a DUI. I still don't have a really good relationship with her, but not that those were my choices, but I always think it's kind of funny. So I get a DUI. And I go to jail, and they made me sit there for a while, and I'm in and out of a blackout, and they said, here's your mattress, and you need to go up those stairs, that's where your cell is. And I had a green jumpsuit on, and everyone else had orange on. And I couldn't get the mattress up the stairs. And I was like, excuse me, can someone help me get my mattress up the stairs? Exactly. They laughed. They were like, right, you know. Finally, I got it up there, but it was that night in that cell. There was another girl in there, and she was hysterical. I don't even know what she was there for, but I just said, you know what? This is not where I belong. I'm going nowhere, and I'm going fast. And so needless to say, the next day I got out and was on probation for 9 months, and I had to go to do some service work, and I went to two classes, and they suggested that we go to an AA meeting. So I went with a guy friend from work who had been in and out of the program, and I really liked it. Because everyone, they, you know, shared their story with me. Each person looked at me and told me their story. And I just thought, they're so nice. These people are great. They're talking to me. And they were great, and they probably saw right through me. But I did decide that, okay, for 9 months I cannot, you know, break my probation. So that first weekend, being sober, hey Harry, I remember waking up really early and just having a full day, and it was like, wow, that's pretty cool. And so I started going to some meetings, got really involved at the 24-hour club in Naples, and I was a secretary, I had a sponsor, and right about 9 months, it was a week before I had 9 months, it was a week before my probation was up, I went to a meeting, and someone said, how are you doing? And I said, I'm okay. And they didn't say, how are you doing? I'm fine, how are you? They didn't notice, but I said, I'm okay. I wanted them to say, what's wrong? And so I left that meeting, and I went, because now I was 21, and before that, I was really pissed off that I wasn't even 21 of age and I was having to get sober because life was over. I'd never have any fun anymore ever for the rest of my life. How could I drink champagne at my wedding, you know? So I left that meeting and I went and bought a six-pack. And, I mean, immediately my behavior changed. Just driving, the music I was listening to, there was, I don't know, Judas Priest, Ozzy Osbourne, something in the tape deck that I didn't normally listen to. But, I mean, just erratic behavior. I went home. My neighbors, two guys who lived next door who were always partying, they were like, finally, you know, come on in. And I'm like, yeah. And but for the next 3 months, it really scared me that I wasn't going to be able to quit drinking. And yeah, I know you've probably heard people say, you know, it's just as bad as it was when you got sober. It's just as bad as it was. I don't think I knew how bad it was, or that it gets worse. I don't think I knew how bad it was until I had some clean time. And then when I went back to it, it was awful. I knew the difference between living with fear and guilt and shame and bruises and no money and waking up in strange places. And I knew the difference. And for the next 3 months, every day on the calendar, okay, I didn't drink today. And then there'd be 2 days that I drank. Okay, I didn't drink these 3 days. And then I did, and then I didn't. And it was very scary. I was very fearful because I knew what it was like to not party all the time. And I was afraid that I wouldn't be able to quit. And then another thing was is that I didn't think that I had drank long enough. I'd only drank 5 years. And but I know in 5 years' time I did enough damage in here that was it. I didn't have to drink anymore. I didn't have to drink for a long stretch of time. So I started going back to meetings, and I decided that I was tired of seeing cows laying underneath palm trees in South Florida, because where I grew up, they were just on the other side of the field. And so some friends of mine came to Napa, but they were in Naples on spring break, and they said, why don't you come to Atlanta? It's a great big city, it's lots of recovery, and you can go back to school. And I was like, well, okay. So I got here in June of 1990, and this is the first place I came to meetings. And Henry Gibbons met me at the door. Yeah, you know. But I'm not going to hold that against him. And this is where I came. And I was terrified of the big city and didn't know what to expect. I was always looking over my shoulder, but not when I was here. And I was here two or three times a day, every day. And this was a safe place. So in these same rooms, in this room, I met the father of my children. And about 4 years later, we got married, and he and my best friend and her fiancé, that was my support group. And we went around and did all kinds of things together and came here and led meetings and did all kinds of good stuff in recovery. I also sponsored a couple of people during that time, and ended up working the steps during that time myself, which the first year I was in the program, it was more of a social thing for me, and then it was time to get serious for me. I don't think I even realized that until recently, but that's okay. I'm still here. So after 4 years, I married this guy, and I thought I was old enough. I was 27, and I had our first child, and she used to come to meetings here, and now at almost 17, she is coming to meetings here because she has almost a year of sobriety, and which I'm very proud of. And if you have a teenager, they will make you want to drink, but I didn't, thankfully. But after that first child was born, meetings started to slow down because now I'm living the life that I was given so freely in Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm supposed to be a mom. I don't have to go to meetings all the time. And then I had a second child, and then I really didn't go to any meetings. And it was very hit and miss. In fact, there's a joke with Brooks and Terry that I only show up here to pick up a chip every year, which is what I did. And I'm sorry they're not here tonight. So meetings slowed down, and married life with two children and no meetings with two alcoholics living together got pretty rough. And it wasn't, you know, what I got sober to do. I didn't get sober to be unhappy. And so I left, and he relapsed. And I tell you honestly, there were days that I thought of using, but there was no way in hell he was going to have more time than me. And that is the only thing that kept me sober. I'm being honest, you know. It was like, no, because if I did, then he'd have more time than me, and that's just not going to fly. So I did come to some Al-Anon meetings and tried to work on that part of it. And I'm not downing Al-Anon because I think every group has its purpose. But when I came to a meeting, one of those meetings, they were talking about me. And I needed to talk about the alcoholic in my life. Not about me. Y'all don't need to talk about me. I need to talk about that one. But I did start coming to meetings after I left because, of one, I didn't want to relapse. And, two, I didn't know what else to do. But this was where I'd always come. This was secure. I knew that. And so I kind of had to rebuild myself. I had however many years of clean time, but I wasn't really sober. And I still come to meetings, and I still feel like a newcomer. There are days when I'm like, God, I probably should go pick up a white chip. I just feel that insecure, and, you know, I don't have anything to offer. And that's okay. I mean, we're all at different stages in our recovery, and that's what keeps this thing moving. And I ended up getting a divorce after 7 long years, and I went to therapy and to find out who I am, and I had friends again, and I went dancing, and actually that's where I met my sweet husband. I'm going to say my current husband because, well, he is my current husband. He's the last one. But, and, you know, we talked about how we actually lived across the street from each other in an apartment complex in 1990, whatever, and we never met. And we've often talked about how if we'd met at that time, it wouldn't have worked, you know. I had to go through everything I've gone through to get right here. And he's had to go through everything he's gone through to get where he is. And I think by self-awareness and going through all my experiences makes me who I am. And same thing with him. So I think that's pretty neat when you put a little effort into who am I, what do I want, this is acceptable and that's not, and stay true to that instead of just letting it go or putting it into kids or work or whatever. That's when I found for me I started to kind of lose myself. Healthy relationships are possible. And my husband, he is, in the sweetest way, he will say, you know, you might want to go to a meeting. And he's not one of us, but I told him long ago, I said, if you ever see me acting a little crazy, don't forget, I mean, you know, don't hesitate. And he hasn't, thankfully. He gets it. You know, he's been around enough people in his family who are in and out of recovery, and thankfully he's not for him. So it works. It's important to keep coming to meetings. Like I said, it really... I've done what I've done to get where I am, and that's great because here I am tonight. But at the same time, sometimes I'll think, what would have happened if I had been going to meetings the whole time? And I don't know, because that's not part of my story. I think that all the promises have come true. They will come true. They don't come true all at the same time. And they are not true every single day. There are pieces and parts that are true on a daily basis and some that aren't. And there may be a stretch of time when you're not seeing any of them. But they do come true. And I remember when I first got here, that was my favorite thing to read. I want to read the promises because they're happy and they're joyful and they are, you know, they really are. And what a gift they are. My favorite slogan is life is good. And when I think about that, you know, you can say that all day. Life is good. Yeah. I mean, I had a tire cover on my Pathfinder that said life is good. Just to irritate people in traffic in the morning, you know, on 285. I'm like, I wonder how many people are getting pissed off, you know, at my life is good. Whatever. But that's okay. You know, that's their thing, not mine, because it is good. Even on the worst day, there were a couple of times that I ripped it off the back of my car. And I was like, no, not today. It's just not. And there have been quite a few times that I was just like, okay, that's it. I don't know what else to do. But I also learned to just wait. Be quiet, you know, the 24-hour rule. Don't make a decision, you know, instantly, to just wait and be still. And then not too far past, I remember just going, okay, I've learned all I need to learn. You can stop any time now because these lessons are killing me. But I made it through, and I didn't have to use, and I didn't have to drink, and that's what this program has taught me. It feels good to not have to be afraid to go anywhere I want to. My husband is a musician, and I know I can go anywhere he is as long as my motives are pure, because that's what I was taught. If your motives are pure, you can go into a club to dance, because I'm there to dance. I'm not there to get drunk. I'm not there to pick up or to be picked up. I'm there to dance and to enjoy the music. And again, you know, I didn't get sober not to have any fun, thankfully. In fact, I won a dance contest in this room Valentine's Day 19 whenever. And I still tell my kids, yeah, but I want a dance contest. They're like, and an AA dance, Mom. And I'm like, yeah, I did. So I went to went with my daughter to a New Year's Eve party recently. And it was at a treatment center. And I felt so bad for those who were afraid to get up and dance and express themselves, you know, because I was that awkward person at one time and who just, I wanted to do it, but I was scared. And then I just started doing it. And now I don't even think about it. You know, it doesn't matter what you think of me unless I'm harming you. But if I'm just being me, it's none of my business what you think about me. That's another thing that I've really had to grasp and hold on to, is that, you know, if I can sleep at night, I'm okay. I don't have to worry about anything else unless I'm harming someone. And, you know, making amends as soon as I screw up, because I do, helps me as well. And so working, you know, the steps, and I always have to turn around and look and see which one it is. Nine. I was telling my daughter that the other night, too. I was like, you would think as long as I've been around here, I would know these things, you know, oh, step 10, step 7, and I don't retain that. That's why I have to keep coming to meetings, so I can start retaining some of it. Some of it just kind of is threaded in there, and it's there. But it takes a while, you know. I can't memorize things and spout it off to you. I will say, if school had been set to music, I've been a straight A student, because I can remember lyrics to any song, but I can't remember anything else, you know. So I don't know how we're doing on time. How are we doing on time? I'm ready to wrap it up.
Whatever you're comfortable with, it's 15 till 9 right now.
Can we do our Q&A now? If you're new coming into this weird thing with all the weird slogans on the wall, it's okay. You know, I thought they were really corny, and first things first, what does that mean? You know, one day at a time, sweet Jesus is what the song I always heard. And but you will use those things and not think twice about them going forward. And you know, as hokey as they are, I remember sitting in a restaurant in South Florida with my friend Anne Marie and having a 30-day chip. And it was a 3-month chip. And in Florida, they have the Serenity Prayer on the back, and just repeating it over and over and over, because we were with some guy who was so whacked, and just over and over and over. It's just those little things, you know. And if I haven't said anything, I mean, I hope. I was thinking about this. Now I can't remember how to say it, but you know, hopefully you've heard something here tonight that you can take with you, whether it be something good or something that you're not going to do. You know, that's part of it. It's, you know, take what you need, leave the rest. And if you're not sure, you know, these rooms will still be here. It's been 24 years and they're still here. And it works. It works if you work it. And if you don't know what that means, just keep coming back. And Frank will probably be here. So thank you for listening. Good night.
Thank you, Angela. That was an awesome, awesome meeting.
Just another homesick child, tired of running wild, ready to stand trial and move on. Though I'm guilty in your sight, ask for mercy tonight. I can't make it through this fight all alone. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it all out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. As I try to make some sense of this world I'm up against, well, I know my best defense is your love. When the struggle gets insane and the lessons full of pain, keep me calling out your name with love. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you
just shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. From the bottom of my heart, and I'm searching for one star to shine. I will shout for mountain high, and I'll reach into the sky till you open up my eyes so blind. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt.